Whoa, look at you! All-American kid! A voice boomed from the couch opposite the entry door. I stopped in the doorway and looked down at the squinting man who was addressing me. Yes, sir, I said. You ever played baseball? He asked. 12 years, from 6 years old till I was 18. Great! You got the job. We start shooting in 2 weeks.
$48,500 to play baseball for 10 weeks in Oakland. You kidding me?
And I needed it. I only had $1,200 to my name at the time. I called my brother Pat to share the news. Fuck yeah, little brother. Super Bowl's coming up. Let's go to Vegas and celebrate. On me. Green light. Now, I like to gamble. Mostly on myself, but occasionally on sports, specifically NFL football. I never bet enough to change my lifestyle, win or lose, but rather just enough to buy a ticket to the game. Meaning, enough to make me want to watch it closely and give a damn. Enough to get a buzz. For me, that can be $50. I've never used a tout service, aka expert pickers, because to me, what's the fun in that? If I lose, I try to figure out where I misread the matchup. But ultimately, I like to pick my own winners because when I win, I knew it. When I win, it was easy. Such a clear choice. A lead pipe cinch. I'm a fortune teller. Nostradamus. A magician. All because I fucking knew it. That's what I love about betting. And I give a lot more credit to the I knew it than I do to the what the fuck happened. I bet for the entertainment value. The enjoyment I get when I knew it. When betting, I specifically enjoy considering the intangibles. The bet on San Francisco at home to cover against Baltimore because Baltimore will be jet lagged from the long flight west bet. The take Brett Favre and the Packers on Monday night because his dad passed away last Tuesday. Or the bet on any team who has a star player who just had his first newborn child because they're now playing for more than themselves bet. The bet against the Philadelphia Eagles because they're playing their first game in their new stadium and have Sylvester Stallone, aka Rocky Balboa, there to commemorate it because it's too much celebration about stuff off the football field bet. When I win these bets based on these psychological hunches and tells that are neither scientific nor measured by the Vegas line makers, I believe I have an inside track. Betting 5.0, Machiavellian craft, all because I knew it. I flew Southwest Airlines to Vegas for the big game. The second year in a row, the Dallas Cowboys and the Buffalo Bills would meet in the Super Bowl. An agent, a $48,500 job in hand, a weekend of blackjack, boozing, and football with my brother Pat, I was flying high. The Dallas Cowboys were a powerhouse that season. Troy Aikman, Emmitt Smith, Charles Haley, Michael Irvin. They had drubbed the Bills in the previous Super Bowl and opened as 10.5-point favorites in this one. The line was stretching further in Dallas's favor, already up to 12.5. The Saturday night before Super Bowl Sunday, Pat and I dominated the blackjack table for 11 straight hours and walked out of the casino at daybreak up big. I'd won almost $2,000 and Pat was up over $4,000, major money for both of us at the time. We woke up Sunday around noon and started strategizing on who we were going to bet on and why. And I think plus 10.5 was too many points to begin with, and it's already up to plus 13 at the Aladdin, I said. Second time's a charm, bro. Let's go, Bills. Shit, I think they might even upset the Cowboys' money line, Pat said. Let's round the wagons with the Bills, little brother, and hammer them every which way we can. An hour before kickoff, we found a casino that had Buffalo at an astronomically high plus 14.5 points, and we placed our bet. We put our money together, $6,000 total, and laid our bets on the Bills in every way you can imagine. $4,000 to cover the 14.5 spread. $1,000 to win $3,200 on the Bills' money line. $250 at 8-1 that Thurman Thomas gets more yards than Emmitt Smith. $250 at 12-1 that Andre Reed has more yards than Michael Irvin. $250 at 6-1 that Jim Kelly throws for more yards than Troy Aikman. $100 at 18-1 that Bruce Smith is the MVP. $100 at 4-1 that Dallas has more than 1.5 turnovers. We bet every penny we had except for $100 for our beer. At halftime, the Bills were up 13-6. We were dancing, singing, and buying doubles. Holy shit, we're going to upgrade to first class for the flight home. We are geniuses, and we're getting 14.5 points. We knew it! But you know what happened, right?
Dallas scored 24 unanswered points in the second half and not only won the game, but covered the 14.5-point spread 31-13. Emmitt Smith outrushed Thurman Thomas. Michael Irvin had more yards than Andre Reed. Jim Kelly did not have more passing yards than Troy Aikman. Bruce Smith was not the MVP, and Dallas turned the ball over once. We lost every single bet we placed, every one. Heads now hanging, our buzz turned into fatigue. We walked out of the casino and hailed a cab to take us back to the hotel with $20 between us. A dusty yellow 86 Bonneville with its back left bumper grazing the pavement pulled up. Holiday Inn, we said as we got in. Behind the wheel was a shaggy old guy who hadn't shaved in 3 months or showered 3 days. Clearly taking interest in our defeated body language, he reached up to his rearview mirror and tilted it to get a better look at us as he pulled away from the curb. Pat and I were staring out our backseat windows in stunned silence, wondering what in the hell had just happened. When an all-knowing voice boomed through the cab.
Ah, you bet on the Bills, did ya? Could have told you that was a stupid-ass bet. I knew the Cowboys were gonna kill him, you fucking losers.
Pat stared ice picks into the guy through the rearview mirror, then exploded.
Oh yeah, motherfucker? If you knew the Cowboys were gonna cover, then what the fuck are you doing driving a cab?
Everybody likes to be in the know. Even when we lose two and win one, we believe the one more than the two. We believe the one winner we picked was a product of our truer selves, was when we met our potential and read the future, was when we were gods. The two losses, however, were aberrations, misfits, glitches in our masterminds, even though the math clearly makes them the majority. After the game is played, everybody knew who the winner would be. Everybody is lying. Nobody knows who's going to win or cover the bet. There is no sure thing. That's why it's called a bet. There's a reason Vegas and Reno continue to grow. They know we bettors love to believe we do. That is a lock.
Bumper sticker. Most of the time, it's not stolen. It's right where you left it.
A month into shooting Angels in the Outfield, the studio behind Boys on the Side flew me back to Hollywood for my follow-up audition in front of director Herbert Ross. I'd been rehearsing for the part every night after playing baseball and was confident I had a take on my man. Herbert liked my audition and I got offered the role. My very first audition in Hollywood had got me a second audition that landed me the fourth lead in a major motion picture drama starring Drew Barrymore, Mary Louise Parker, and Whoopi Goldberg. It also got me a major paycheck of $150,000. As soon as I finished playing baseball in Oakland, I headed to Tucson, Arizona, where we'd be shooting Boys on the Side. Instead of the hotel where most others were staying, I rented a quaint adobe guest house on the edge of the Saguaro National Park outside town. I rescued a black lab chow mix puppy from the local pound and named her Miss Hud, after Paul Newman's character in one of my favorite films. The house came with a maid. I'd never had a maid before. One Friday night after work, a friend of mine, Beth, came over for dinner and drinks. Like a kid on Christmas morning, I was telling her all the things I was so happy about with my new digs. The mud brick architecture, the national park is my backyard, the fact that it came with the maid, yes, especially the maid. I mean, she cleans the place after I go to work, washes my clothes, does the dishes, puts fresh water by my bed, leaves me cooked meals, and she even presses my jeans. I told Beth, holding up my Levi's to show her the crisp, starched white line running down the legs. Beth smiled at my enthusiasm, then said something I hadn't ever thought to ask myself and haven't forgotten to since. Well, that's great, Matthew, if you want your jeans pressed. I'd never had my jeans pressed before. I'd never had anyone to press my jeans before. I'd never thought to ask myself if I wanted my jeans pressed before, because for the first time in my life, I could have them pressed. The never-before-offered opulent option now being a reality, of course I wanted my jeans pressed. Or did I? No, actually, I didn't.
Note to self, when you can, ask yourself if you want to before you do.
After Boys on the Side, I returned to Malibu, now with my own loft on the beach.
I started taking acting classes for the first time because I thought it was time to start learning the craft that I had practically fallen into. In the past, I'd always just gone with my instincts, and they had served me well. Now, I was back in school, getting an education on how to read a script, what to look for, how to prepare for a role, how to study, how to be, I thought, a professional actor. Meanwhile, I hadn't gotten work in the 6 months since rapping Boys on the Side. I hadn't worked since I started taking those acting classes. I had a lot of auditions and quite a few callbacks, but I couldn't seem to land a gig. I wondered why. I noticed I was more uptight and not taking as many risks in the auditions as I used to. I was tense. I was earnest. I was literal. I was heady. The new intellectual exercise had me getting in my own way. Note to self. The intellect is not meant to surpass the apparent so far as to conceal it or make it more confusing. It is meant to expose the truth more clearly and reveal more of the obvious from more lines of sight. It should simplify things, not make them more cerebral. Finally, I received a blind offer for a minor role in a small independent film called Scorpion Spring. I'd only be in one scene. They offered $10,000 and I took it. No audition, shooting in 2 weeks, that's all I knew. I decided that that was all I wanted to know. I got the script and I didn't read one page of it, not a word, not even of the scene I was in. Why? Because I had a bright idea. To lubricate my creative juices and rid myself of all the theoretical tension I had been carrying since the last movie in those classes, I decided I was going to go back to how I acted when I first started, when I played this guy named David Wooderson, when reading just one line of the script completely unlocked the character for me. It was easy for me to improvise in all those other unscripted scenes in Days to Confuse because I was confident I knew who my man was, comfortable to just say and do what Wooderson would in any scene the director put me in. Back when I was all instinct, a natural. Well, I said to myself, that's what I've been missing. Enough of this academic, tight-minded, learned, studying shit I've been doing. It's time to return to my roots. In Scorpion Spring, my man was an American drug runner in South Texas who meets up with a Mexican coyote smuggling his dope back into the States, who then reneges on the deal, doesn't pay for the smuggled drugs, and instead kills the smugglers and takes the cocaine for free. That's all I needed to know. Just be that guy. Handle the situation like he would. Improvise, McConaughey. Do what my man would do. Easy. 2 weeks later, I'm on location in my trailer. I know my man. I've created my backstory of an upper mid-level drug runner who works for the cartel on the American side in Texas. I need the cocaine and the money, and I'm carrying a loaded pistol, willing to kill to get out alive with both. I even look the part. Unshaven, greasy black hair, black boots, leather jacket. Who needs a fucking script? I know who I am. Press record. I got this. Time to go to set. Time to shoot the scene. No problem. I arrive in character. I don't talk to anyone. I don't introduce myself to the other actors in the scene with me because my man doesn't care about them and my man is going to kill them in this scene anyway. I just want my cocaine for free. Just before we take our marks, a production assistant comes up to me. Some sides, Mr. McConaughey? I take them and just shove them in my pocket without looking at them. All the actors settle onto their marks and prepare for action. Here we go. Well, I guess I lost my nerve a little bit because I decided it would be a good idea right at this moment, just before we roll the camera, to have a quick peek at the scene and the dialogue. My thinking at the time... If it's written well, I'll immediately remember the written lines because obviously that's what my man would say. And if it's not written well, then I'll just be my man and do and say what he would do and say anyway. I unfold the sides and have a look. One page. Two pages. Three pages. Four pages of a monologue. In Spanish. Holy shit. I feel a bead of sweat form on the back of my neck. My heart starts racing. What the fuck am I going to do? My mouth goes dry. I try to keep calm. And then I look up to no one in particular. And aloud to the set, I say, can I get 12 minutes, please? My half-assed thinking was that 12 minutes would, one, be enough time to memorize all the Spanish, because, hey, I took a semester of Spanish class in the 11th grade, and two, not enough time to inconvenience the crew. I take a little walk with the sides, a 12-minute walk to be precise. I then return to set, put the sides back in my pocket, and step to my mark. The director says, action, and we shoot the scene. I have never watched Scorpion Spring. I did learn a good lesson that day, though. We have to prepare to have freedom. We have to do the work to then do the job. We have to prepare for the job so we can be free to do the work. Knowing my man does not mean I know Spanish. Note to self, we must learn the consequence of negligence. It's not just what we do, it's what we don't do that's important as well. We are guilty by omission. A few months later, having quit the acting classes but learned my lesson, I was back on the Warner Brothers lot in director Joel Schumacher's office to discuss a possible role in his next film, A Time to Kill, based on the book by John Grisham. The irresponsibility of my half-cocked idea not to fully prepare for the last part had value. I was embarrassed. The embarrassment pissed me off, and that rage made me more daring. Joel and I were meeting to discuss the part of Freddie Lee Cobb, a young head of the Ku Klux Klan in a small Mississippi town. I had read the script this time. I'd even read the book. Freddie Lee Cobb was a strong and stirring role, but it wasn't the one I wanted. No, the man I wanted was the lead, Jake Brigance, a young lawyer who defends a black man for killing the men who raped his daughter. I showed up in Joel's office that day with a plan. Wearing a sleeveless John Mellencamp t-shirt and casually smoking a Marlboro, I sat across the desk from him. "I think you'd be a great Freddie Lee Cobb, Matthew," he said. "Yeah, I do too, Mr. Schumacher. I understand, you know, where he came from and why he is who he is, but who's playing the lead role of Jake Brigance?" Joel paused and cocked his head a bit. "I don't know," he said. "Who do you think should?" I leaned back in my chair, took a healthy drag, and on the exhale, looking him dead in the eyes, said, "I think I should." Joel burst into laughter. "Ah, I think that's a great idea, Matthew, but it is never going to happen. The studio will never put a relatively unknown actor in the lead role." I stubbed out my cigarette and held his gaze. I had pulled off the first part of my plan. Note to self. If only means you wanted something but did not get it. For some reason, either by your own incompetence or the world's intervention, it did not happen. Sometimes this is just the breaks and we need to bow out gracefully. But more often than we care to admit, we don't get what we want because we quit early or we didn't take the necessary risk to get it. The more boots we put in the backside of our if onlys, the more we will get what we want. Don't walk the it's too late, it's too soon tightrope until you die. Now, what happened next was certainly not part of my plan, but a lot of things that were out of my control went my way. Sandra Bullock, who was already cast as Ellen Roark in A Time to Kill, had recently starred in a film called While You Were Sleeping, which had recently opened with a respectable first weekend of just under $10 million. But since I'd planted the seed with Joel, While You Were Sleeping had crept up to over $80 million in domestic box office revenue. It was a big hit, and had made Sandra Hollywood's newest green light movie star, which meant that studios believed she was popular enough to headline a film. With an actress who could now open a film already cast in the number three supporting role in A Time to Kill, Warner Brothers was suddenly free to consider a less bankable actor for the lead role. But did that mean Joel Schumacher started to take my suggestion seriously? Apparently not. They were considering my now great friend and brother from another mother, Woody Harrelson, for the role of Jake Brigance. Then the plot twisted again. Turns out John Grisham also had casting approval on the role of Jake Brigance, as the character was based on himself. Also turns out that on March 7, 1995, a man named Bill Savage was murdered in Mississippi. The murderers, a young man and woman, said they were inspired by Mickey and Mallory, the characters brought to life by Woody Harrelson, Juliette Lewis, and Oliver Stone's Natural Born Killers. Bill Savage was John Grisham's friend, and there was no way the guy who played Mickey in that film was going to play Jake Brigance in this one. Filming was scheduled to commence in 6 to 8 weeks in Canton, Mississippi. All the roles were cast, except for Jake Brigance. A couple of weeks later, I was on the rooftop of a Mexican restaurant in L.A., having a 4 p.m. margarita with my manager, Beth Holden, when my phone rang. "I want you to come in for a screen test, Matthew," Joel Schumacher said over the phone. It had been 2 months since I'd planted the seed. "We'll do it next Sunday in a small private studio on Fairfax so no one will know, because even if you do great, it's such a long shot that the studio will approve you. I don't want the perceived failure to be on your resume around town. The scene I want you to test with is Jake's final summation." Sunday came. It was Mother's Day. I called mine at daybreak. "Don't you walk in there like you want the role, Matthew. Walk in there like you own it." Just what I needed to hear. Thanks, Mom. Happy Mother's Day. Note to self, made for the moment. We are all made for every moment we encounter, whether the moment makes us or we make the moment, whether we are helpless in it or on top of it, the predator or the prey, we are made for that moment. A black car picked me up at 11 a.m. and drove me to the studio on Fairfax. There was a makeup artist, a costume designer, a director of photography, and a crew of around 30 people. Around 1 p.m., I walked onto the set, which was a courtroom with 12 actors, all sitting in a set-made jury box. I was nervous, but I was prepared. Everyone quieted down and took their places. "Whenever you're ready, Matthew," Joel said. I caught my breath and began to enact the final summation just as it was written in the script until I finished it with the now classic line, "Now, imagine she's white." It was good, not great. I'd remembered my lines, hit all the beats, taken my time, and told the story well. More than passable, but nothing special. "Great, Matthew," Joel said. "Now throw away the script and just say what you'd say." Therein lies Joel Schumacher's genius. Be you. You are the character. I love that note. What I would say and do. How do I feel about a young virgin girl being raped by 3 vile men? What did they kill in her that day? What if she was my sister? What if it was my daughter? It was Mother's Day. I tossed the script off the set and out of my mind. I began to slowly pace. My eyes began to burn. And with rage building, I painted the dreadful pictures in my mind and said what I saw. Not yet a father myself, but a father being the only thing I ever knew I wanted to be, I imagined my daughter getting raped. I forgot testing. I forgot time. I said and did things a lawyer in a courtroom would never say or do. I cussed. I spit. I painted cringeworthy pictures of a child's lost innocence with bloody words that could have put me in jail alongside those I was condemning. I got sick to my stomach. I got violent. I broke a sweat. I nailed it. 2 weeks later, working on the set of Lone Star in Eagle Pass, Texas, in the full moon desert at midnight, I got a phone call. It was Joel Schumacher and John Grisham. "You want to be Jake Brigance?" "You damn right I do." I ran off into the night until I was about a mile away from anyone. Then, with tears in my eyes, I dropped to my knees, faced that full moon, extended my right hand up to it, and said, "Thank you." Green light. Ready for a prescribe? Here we go. A roof is a man-made thing. January 3rd, 1993, NFL playoffs, Houston Oilers versus the Buffalo Bills. The Oilers are up 28-3 at halftime, 35-3 early in the third. Frank Reich and the Bills come back to win 41-38 in overtime for one of the greatest comebacks in NFL history. Yeah, the Bills won, but they didn't really beat the Oilers. The Oilers lost that game. They beat themselves. Why? Because at halftime, they put a ceiling, a roof, a limit on their belief in themselves, a.k.a. the prevent defense. Maybe they started thinking about the next opponent at halftime, played on their heels, lost their mental edge the entire second half, and voila, they lost. In a mere 2 quarters, defensive coordinator Jim Eddy went from being called defensive coordinator of the year and the man first in line to be a head coach next year to a man without a job in the NFL or even college football the next year. You ever choked? You know what I mean. Fumbled at the goal line, stuck your foot in your mouth when you were trying to ask that girl out on a date, had a brain freeze on the final exam you were totally prepared for, lipped out a 3-foot putt to win the golf tournament, or been paralyzed by the feeling of, oh my God, life can't get any better. Do I really deserve this? I have. What happens when we get that feeling? We clench up. We get short of breath, self-conscious. We have an out-of-body experience where we observe ourselves in the third person, no longer present, now not doing well what we are there to do. We become voyeurs of our moment because we let it become bigger than us. And in doing so, we just became less involved in it and more impressed with it. Why does this happen? It happens because when we mentally give a person, place, or point in time more credit than ourselves, we then create a fictitious ceiling, a restriction over the expectations we have of our own performance in that moment. We get tense, we focus on the outcome instead of the activity, and we miss the doing of the deed. We either think the world depends on the result, or it's too good to be true. But it doesn't, and it isn't, and it's not our right to believe it does or is. Don't create imaginary constraints. A leading role, a blue ribbon, a winning score, a great idea, the love of our life, euphoric bliss. Who are we to think we don't deserve these fortunes when they are in our grasp? Who are we to think we haven't earned them? If we stay in process within ourselves, in the joy of the doing, we will never choke at the finish line. Why? Because we aren't thinking of the finish line. We're not looking at the clock. We're not watching ourselves on the Jumbotron performing. We are performing in real time, where the approach is the destination. And there is no goal line because we are never finished. When Bo Jackson scored, he ran over the goal line, through the end zone, and up the tunnel. The greatest snipers and marksmen in the world don't aim at the target. They aim on the other side of it. When we truly latch on to the fact that we are going to die at some point in time, we have more presence in this one. Reach beyond your grasp, have immortal finish lines, and turn your red light green, because a roof is a man-made thing. The day of the opening of A Time to Kill, I strolled to my favorite deli on the 3rd Street Promenade in Santa Monica, California. Get a tuna fish sandwich on toasted sourdough with extra pickles and ketchup on the side. It was like any other stroll down that promenade for me. 400 or so people milling about, 396 made nothing of me, 4 did, a few girls who thought I was cute, and 1 dude who liked my shoes. That night, A Time to Kill premiered in theaters across America and grossed $15 million in its opening weekend, a box office hit in 1996. The following Monday, I went back to the promenade to get another tuna fish sandwich on toasted sourdough with extra pickles and ketchup on the side. It was not like any other stroll down that promenade for me. 400 or so people milling about, 396 stared at me, 4 did not, 3 babies and a blind man. I checked my fly and lightly thumbed my nose to see if I had a booger hanging out. I didn't. What the fuck? I was famous. Note to self, sometimes you have etc., sometimes etc. has you. The hype surrounding my arrival was off the charts, being hailed as the next big thing. Matthew McConaughey saves the movies was the bold-faced caption behind my head on the cover of certain industry magazines. Save the movies? Hell, I didn't know they needed saving, and if they did, I wasn't sure I was or wanted to be the one to save them. I just wanted to act, to play roles that interested me and stories that mattered to me. From that day on, the world became a mirror. Strangers laid their hands on me and spoke to me like they knew me well. Actually, they weren't strangers at all anymore. People I'd never seen or met before would approach me and say, "My dog had cancer too. I am so sorry about Miss Hud." And I thought, how did you know I had a dog? How did you know her name? How did you know she might have cancer? What happened to introducing yourself? Everyone had a preconceived bio of me now. Honest first impressions were a thing of the past. That check had been cashed. My world had changed. In the words of James McMurtry, now it's upside down and backwards, the foot's on the other shoe. Everyone loved me now, and they weren't shy to say it out loud and often. Me? I'd only said it to 4 people in my life. Anonymous, no more, and forever. The same happened with scripts. The Friday before opening weekend, there were 100 scripts that I wanted to do, 99 no's, 1 yes. The Monday after, 99 yeses, 1 no. Wow. Awesome. Shit. What was real? What was not? The sky just opened up to me, and it was tough to feel the ground beneath my feet.
My differential split, my spiritual foundation in flight. I needed some gravity. It was time to bend my knee bone.
Prescribe, why we all need a walkabout. Noise to signal ratio. We are more constantly bombarded by unnatural stimuli than ever before. We need to put ourselves in places of decreased sensory input so we can hear the background signals of our psychological processes. As the noise decreases, the signals become clearer. We can hear ourselves again. We can reunite. Time alone simplifies the heart. Memory catches up. Opinions form. We meet truth again, and it teaches us. Landing on stable feet between our reaching out and retreat, letting us know we are not lonely in our state, just alone. Because our unconscious mind now has room to reveal itself, we see it again. It dreams, perceives, and thinks in pictures, which we now can observe. In this solitude, we then begin to think in pictures and actualize what we see. Our souls become anonymous again, and we realize we are stuck with the one person we can never be rid of, ourselves. The Socratic dialogue can be ugly, painful, lonesome, hard, guilt-ridden, and a nightmare vicious enough to need a mouth guard not to gnaw our fangs into nubs while we sweat cold in feverish panic. We are forced to confront ourselves. And this is good. We more than deserve this suffrage. We've earned it. An honest man's pillow is his peace of mind, and no matter who's in our bed each night, we sleep with ourselves. We either forgive or get sick and tired of it. Herein lies the evolution. Now, with nowhere to run and forced to deal with ourselves, our ugly everyday suppressions break out of the zoo and monkey around, where we find ourselves in the ring with him, deciding no more or let it slide. Whatever the verdict, we grow. It's us and us, our always and only company. We tend to ourselves and get in good graces once again. Then we return to civilization, able to better tend to our tendencies. Why? Because we took a walkabout. The Monastery of Christ in the Desert sits in miles of undisturbed desert on the banks of the Chama River in Abiquiu, New Mexico. The 13.5-mile dirt road from the highway that leads you there is usually washed out, so you can't bring a car. Thomas Merton loved it there. He said this monastery was a place where people can go to readjust their perspectives. I read about it in a book and thought, that's exactly what I needed this time, a spiritual realignment. I was all messed up in the head, lost in the excess of my newfound fame and struggling with a non-deserving complex. My now roofless existence not only had me searching for my bearings, it was bearing down on me. How could a working-class kid from Uvalde, Texas, be deserving of all this opulence and accolade? I didn't know how to navigate the decadence of my success, much less believe it was mine to enjoy. I didn't know who to trust, including myself. In the book, the brothers said that if you can get to us, just ring the bell and we'll take you in. A good friend and I drove from Hollywood to that dirt road where he dropped me off, and I made the 13.5-mile march to the monastery. I arrived an hour after sundown and rang the bell. Dressed in a cowl and tunic, a short man named Brother Andre greeted me. Welcome, brother. All travelers have a place to stay here. I washed up and went to the group dinner where psalms were read aloud and talking was strictly prohibited. Later, Brother Andre ushered me to a small, simple room with a cot and a sleeping mat on the floor where I lay down for the night. The next day, I said to Brother Andre, I need to talk to someone about some things going on in my life and in my mind. Do you know who I could talk to? Yes, he said. Brother Christian would be a good man for you to talk to about such things. I met Brother Christian, and we went for a long walk in the desert. I unloaded my feelings of guilt, the low and lecherous places my mind had been traveling, the perverseness of my thoughts. Since becoming famous, I professed, I've tried to be a good man, you know, to not lie and deceive myself, to be more pure of heart and mind, but I'm full of lust. Objectifying other people and myself, I do not feel a connection to my past nor see a path to my future. I'm lost. I just don't feel myself. I shared the demons of my mind for 3.5 hours with Brother Christian. I took myself to the woodshed. He did not say a word. Not one. He just patiently listened as we wandered side by side through the desert. At hour 4, we found ourselves back at the chapel, sitting on a bench just outside the entrance. Now weeping, I eventually came to the end of my confession. We sat in silence while I awaited Christian's judgment. Nothing. Finally, in the unrest of the stillness, I looked up. Brother Christian, who hadn't said one word to me this entire time, looked me in the eyes and in almost a whisper said to me, "Me too." Oh, sometimes, you see, we don't need advice. Sometimes we just need to hear we're not the only one. Green light. Prescription time again. Both are true. Now look, I'm an optimist by nature. My eye is high. I have hope. And the man I want to be sleeps in the same bed with the man I am, in head, heart, spirit, and body. I don't always enjoy my company because of that son of a bitch Jiminy Cricket, but I'm rarely able to knock him off my shoulder either. And for good reason. Even when I'm out of tune, off frequency, having trouble feeling any traction or viscosity between my being and my actions, or alternately, when I am so lost in the music that I am unaware, my best self is always there, and he will start the Socratic dialogue sooner than I choose to hear him and long after I want to, because he's insatiable. I, of course, eventually do hear him. Then the challenge becomes to listen. Once I do this and stop pitting fate against responsibility, truth against fiction, sins against who I wish I was, selfishness against selflessness, mortality against eternity, I learn and then begin just being who I am and doing what I do for me, not for anyone else, and for everyone else at the same time. For me and God together. Then I realize I am responsible for fate. Fiction is truthful. A sinner and a saint I am, an egotistical utilitarian as well. I'll be mortal forever. Now, each step at a time has the big picture in mind, and I am the man I want to be. Jiminy Cricket is a bluebird on my shoulder, and Socrates has one voice. I didn't mishandle my newfound fame as much as I just didn't really have a handle on it. I was numb. Occasionally dumb, and picked a few battles that did not need picking. If I was thrown off balance for a bit, it was mainly because I gave a damn, and it mattered to me what it all meant and didn't. Mostly, I danced lightly between the raindrops. I enjoyed being able to finally put super unleaded gasoline in my truck, picking up the tab when I went out with my friends, getting the backstage passes, and working with so many talented people. I tried to remain a gentleman and accept the caviar, fine wines, and I love yous with grace, but a lot of it felt like the maid was still pressing my jeans after I asked her not to. I made sure to call my mom every Sunday. Only now it wasn't my mom I was calling anymore. It wasn't my mom who was listening to me. It wasn't my mom who was talking to her son. It was a woman who was more enamored with my fame than I was. This was never more evident than when I got a call at home from a friend one night. "Dude, are you watching this?" "Watching what?" "Put it on Channel 7, hard copy," my friend says. I turn on the tube, put it on Channel 7, and there's my mother, talking to the camera that is following her through our house on a guided tour. "And this is the bed where he lost his virginity to Melissa," I think her name was. Anyway, doesn't matter, she didn't last. "And this is his bathroom, just a shower, no bathtub, and you know what I caught him doing in there. Ha ha! But trust me, it's no big deal. I've seen it plenty of times." "Oh, shit." I call Mom. "Mom, what did you do?" "What?" "Hard copy." "What hard copy?" "Mom, I'm watching it right now. You are too. I can hear it in the background." "Oh, that." "Yeah, that." "Well, I didn't think you'd find out." "Mom, it's on national television. How would I not find out?" Sadly, my relationship with my mom was strenuous for the next 8 years. "Loose lips sink ships," I kept telling her. She tried. It didn't matter. She couldn't help herself. She wanted a piece of my fame. And while I was still finding my balance with it, I wasn't self-assured enough to share it with anyone else, especially my own mother. The more she wanted a piece of my place, the more I locked her out. If Dad were alive, he would have loved my success, but unlike Mom, he would have been in the front row, not trying to steal my show. With Mom, as soon as I'd show up, she was saying come back soon, so I started leaving early. I'd give her an inch and she'd take a mile, So when she didn't meet me halfway, I started walking twice as slow to make her wait twice as long. I quit sharing any of my life or experiences with her. I couldn't trust her. I didn't need another friend on my bandwagon. I needed my mom. And unfortunately, she was on another type of extended vacation. Years later, with my feet more firmly on the ground and my career established, I finally said, you know what? Fuck it. And loosened the reins on her. She was in her 70s, and I figured I might as well let her have all the fun she wants to. And to this day, she does. She loves the red carpet, doing interviews, and telling the world she knows where I got it from. Her. She's got a point. Note to self, the art of running downhill. Don't trip yourself while running downhill. That mountain you want to climb, it's just around the corner. Don't invent drama. It will come on its own. It'd been 4 months since A Time to Kill had been released, and I was in high demand. Warner Brothers, who I signed a 3-picture deal with prior to doing A Time to Kill, was anxiously anticipating my next role. Dozens of offers came my way. I even started a production company to create material of my own. I was hungry to go to work. I just didn't know what I wanted to do. One of my strengths has always been that I can find an angle on anything. But now, with the ability to do almost anything, that strength was a weakness. Every project looked possible to me. Note to self, a man addicted to ideas need be intervened with starvation. A man addicted to truths need be fed. Feeling pressure to make a decision on my next movie, smothered by the blind affections of my recent fame, and having a new wild card for a mom, I wanted to go somewhere where nobody knew my name. I needed to reaffirm that I, Matthew, not my fame, was justification for any adulation I received. I needed to go someplace where any affections I collected would be solely based on the man those strangers met and got to know after I arrived, not before. I needed to hear myself think, to check out, to check in, so I could settle into my new position of leverage and measure it, get less impressed with it, find some discernment, and figure out what kind of role in what type of film I wanted to do next. I needed some starvation. Then, I had a wet dream. Yes, the involuntary intercourse, hands and fellatio-free, nocturnal emission of semen one has while sleeping. Rare but welcomed, these lucid dreams most commonly involve a theme of sexual activity. This wet dream was not common. I was seeing myself floating downstream on my back in the Amazon River. Wrapped up by anacondas and pythons, surrounded by crocodiles, piranhas, and freshwater sharks. There were African tribesmen lined up shoulder to shoulder on the ridge to the left of me as far as my eyes could see. I was at peace. 11 frames, 11 seconds. Then I came. I woke up. Whoa. All the elements of a nightmare, but it was a wet dream. Green light. What does it mean, I wondered. There were 2 things I was sure about in the dream. 1, I was on the Amazon River, and 2, those were African tribesmen on the ridge. I got out of bed and grabbed my world atlas, then turned to the continent of Africa and started looking for the Amazon. Well, as you probably know, you can look a mighty long time for the Amazon River in the continent of Africa because you're not going to find it. I looked for that river for 2 hours until I realized, wrong continent. The Amazon's in South America. Damn, dreams can be tricky. Nevertheless, it was a sign and just what I was looking for. It was time to chase down my wet dream. Note to self. Just because the seats are empty doesn't mean they're not taken. Sometimes the guest list needs to be for one. You. I crammed my backpack with minimal clothing, my journal, camera, medical kit, a hit of ecstasy, and my favorite headband, then embarked on a 22-day solo trip to Peru to find and float the Amazon River. Yeah, the one in South America. I flew to Lima, then on to Cusco, where I met a guide and we mapped out my 3-week journey to the Amazon River over Anticuchos and Pisco. I hiked the Andes and along the Urubamba River into the lost city of Machu Picchu, listening to John Mellencamp's album on my Walkman as I climbed. Then I took a bus, boat, and a plane ride to get to the largest city in the world you can't get to by car, Iquitos, the Peruvian capital of the Amazon. It was the 12th night of my 22-day adventure, and I was settling into camp.
had already hiked over 80 miles to this point, and tomorrow I'd finally be in the waters of my wet dream, the Amazon River. Up to this point in the trip, I'd had a hard time being present. So excited in anticipation of what the Amazon would mean to me, I had missed most of the beauties getting here. Still wrestling with my identity, I was guilt-ridden over sins of my past, lonely and disgusted with the company I was keeping, my own. In my tent, grappling with my demons, I couldn't sleep, so I quit trying to. Instead, I stripped off my clothes, along with every badge, banner, expectation, and affiliation I had on me. I discarded my American baseball cap that was my totem to patriotism, the Celtic knot pendant that symbolized my Irish heritage, the Lone Star flag amulet that stood for my Texas pride, and every other mascot of inspiration from adventures past. I even discarded the gold ring my father had given me that was made from a meltdown of his and mom's class rings in gold from one of her teeth. I removed every idol that ever gave me comfort and security, pride, or confidence. All the window dressings and representations, the packaging around my product, was gone. I even punched myself in the face a couple of times for good measure. Who was I? Not only in this trip, but in this life. Now naked and stripped down to nothing, I was only a child of God and nothing more. Soaked in a cold sweat, I vomited until there was no bile left in my belly. Then passed out from exhaustion.
Note to self, sometimes we have to leave what we know to find out what we know.
A few hours later, I awoke on the 13th morning to a rising sun. Surprisingly fresh and energized, I dressed, made some tea, and went for a morning walk. Not toward my destination or any expectation, but rather to nowhere in particular. I felt great, alive, clean, free. Bright. Walking along a muddy path, I turned a corner, and there in the middle of the trail was a mirage of the most magnificent pinks and blues and red colors I had ever seen. It was electric, glowing, and vibrant, hovering just above the jungle floor, pulsing as if it was plugged into some neon-charged power plant. I stopped. I stared. I backed up a pace. There was no way around it, and it was no mirage at all. The jungle floor in front of me was actually a kaleidoscope of thousands of butterflies. It was spectacular. I stayed a while, gaping in wonder. Captivated, I heard this little voice inside my head say these words. All I want is what I can see. All I can see is in front of me. No longer in a rush to get anywhere or anticipating what was around the corner, coming up next or up ahead, time slowed down. I raised my chin to the sky and said a quiet thank you, then glanced down the path just past the massive menagerie of levitating butterflies, and there, for the first time, I saw the Amazon River. The tower of all my anxieties now laying down laterally in front of me, just like that slow-moving river. For the first time in months, I was at ease. A few hours later, I returned to camp to pack for my continued journey. On arrival, my guide called out to me in Spanish.
Soy luz, Mateo, soy luz,
meaning, you are light, Matthew, you are light. Now forgiven, I'd let go of the guilt. My confusion was gone. My penance felt paid. Back in good graces, I shook hands with myself. From that morning on, I was present, embracing only what I could see in front of me and giving it the justice it deserved. For the next 2 weeks, I hiked, canoed, and even macheted my way through the Amazon rainforest on my one hit of ecstasy. And yes, I floated naked on my back down the Amazon River. But no snakes, crocodiles, sharks, or piranhas enveloped me as they had in my dream. I guess they didn't have to anymore. On the final day, while bathing in the river, I did see what looked to be the final wave of a mermaid's tail as it slid beneath the water's surface heading downriver. I waved back. I had crossed a truth. Did I find it? I don't know. I think it found me. Why? Because I put myself in a place to be found. I put myself in a place to receive it. How do we know when we cross a truth or a truth crosses us? I believe the truth is all around us all the time. The anonymous angels, the butterflies, the answers are always right there, but we don't always identify, grasp, hear, see, or access them because we're not in the right place to. We have to make a plan. Green light.
Prescription/prayer. God, when I cross the truth, give me the awareness to receive it, the consciousness to recognize it, the presence to personalize it, the patience to preserve it, and the courage to live it. First, we have to put ourselves in the place to receive the truth. This noisy world we live in, with its commitments, deadlines, fix thises, do thats, and expectations, make it hard to get clarity and peace of mind, famous or not. So we have to consciously put ourselves in a place to receive that clarity. Whether that's prayer, meditation, a walkabout, being in the right company, a road trip, whatever it is for each of us. Then, after we've put ourselves in this place to listen to the gospel and hear their music, we then have to be aware enough to receive it and conscious enough to recognize it. It will arrive nameless because it is clear, omnipresent, unanimous, and infinite. It usually lands like a butterfly, quick and quiet. When we let it in, it needs no introduction. Then the relationship can begin, and we need the presence to personalize it. This is where the anonymous truth gets intimate and becomes autonomous. We ask ourselves what it means, how it's unique to us, and why it's here now. Then comes the harder part, having the patience to preserve it, getting it from our intellect into our bones, soul, and instinct. We must pay attention to it, concentrate on it, keep it lit, and not let it flutter away. This takes time, commitment, and tendance. If we make it this far, after we put ourselves in the right place to receive the truth, recognized it as such, made it our own, and preserved it, then comes the coup de grace. Having the courage to live it. To actually walk away from that place where it found us, take that truth with us into the screaming arena of our daily lives, practice it, and make it an active part of who we are. If we can do that, then we are on our way to heaven on earth, where what we want is what we need, where what we need is what we want. I returned to Hollywood and soon made the decision to play the role of Palmer Joss, opposite Jodie Foster in Robert Zemeckis' Contact. After my spiritual journey on the Amazon, my choice to inhabit a man who believed in God and a world of science was very close to the truth of where I was in my own life and where I wanted to spend my time in front of the camera. Jodie Foster was the clear lead, and people questioned why I took the girl's role, as they called it at the time. Instead of taking other leading roles, I was being offered. But I was more than satisfied with my choice, as I was interested in what I termed philanthropic roles and stories of self-discovery, as well as working with great directors. After we wrapped filming, I continued canoeing rivers. Only now I was ready to row the highways of the United States. So I bought a 1996 GMC Savannah van and tricked it out to suit my fancies. I gutted the interior except for the two front captain chairs and installed a custom-made console with a hideaway cooler and drain, a PA system like I had in my high school truck, and a Rode NT1-A shock-mounted microphone on the end of a bendable arm connected to a cassette recorder that was mounted into the ceiling of the driver's seat so I could make high-end voice recordings while driving down the road. Many have been transcribed and are in this book. I spent $10,000 on an Alpine amp, 10 credit equalizer, and Focal ES speakers for a top-end vintage sound system, fixed a leopard skin couch bed in the back, and drilled a hole in the floor to fit an oil funnel so I could take a pee without having to pull over. I named that van Cosmo, and Miss Hud and I hit the road. Note to self, I've never cared much for destinations. The idea of landing is too finite for my imagination and sense of song. Give me a direction and a 16-lane highway with room to swerve and explore along the way. Like jazz, I prefer to see life as a river. After a few months traversing the states and either sleeping on that leopard skin bed or in a motel, Miss Hud and I decided we were ready to commit to being road dogs, so we upgraded. Purchased a 28-foot Airstream International CCD, hooked it up to the back of Cosmo, and towed our new home on the road behind us. Now fully self-sufficient, Miss Hud and I became what the trailer world calls full-timers. We carved trails from Manitoba to Guatemala and 48 of the 49 reachable United States of America in between. Our compass? Wherever we wanted to go. Our schedule? Whenever we wanted to go there. Roger Clemens is pitching in New York 3 days from now. Well, that's a 3-day drive from Albuquerque, New Mexico, so we'll head out in the morning and make the game. Hey, there's a Cult concert in Detroit the next night. Perfect. We'll swing by for that the day after Clemens takes the bump. I also took my meetings with film directors on the road. For instance, if I was in Utah and headed east, I would schedule my guests to fly into, say, Boulder, Colorado, the next morning and pick them up at the local airport. Then we would drive together and discuss the project for the next 7 hours until I dropped them off the airport in Lincoln, Nebraska, for their flight home. Behind the steering wheel has always been my favorite seat, and driving the highways of America has always been my ideal office. We went on location to Rhode Island, where I got to work with Steven Spielberg on Amistad, a film about a slave revolt aboard a Spanish schooner in 1839 and a case that reached the Supreme Court and became notable in the abolition movement. I also made The Newton Boys with my old friend who gave me my first shot in the business, Richard Linklater. It was about an outlaw gang of brothers who were the most successful train and bank robbers in history. The man I portrayed was Willis Newton, who was from my hometown of Uvalde, Texas. One of the originators of outlaw logic, he'd rather shoot the lock than use a damn key any day. Miss Hud and I enjoyed boondocking and the trailer park life, especially the people we met and observed along the way. For me, this was acting and storytelling 101, a front row seat to real characters and real life. It was live, not Memorex. Behavior, not attitude. I wrote in my diary and recorded in my mic daily. Trailer parks are full of renegades, runaways, professional clowns, rock band guitarists, down on their luckers, wildlife lovers, 4 p.m. cocktailers, book readers, retired couples, single mothers, unicyclers, inventors, patenters, gardeners, dreamers, lost souls, hippies, motorheads, meth cookers, million milers, and iron your own suit at 6 a.m.ers. One thing they all appreciate is minding their own business, and you minding yours. If the door's shut, don't come knocking, is one of the first rules of trailer park living. Sure, I heard Matthew McConaughey staying in the park many times, but after a few waves and head-high howdies, everyone always respected my privacy, because for the most part, everyone honored trailer park rules. When they didn't, the rest of the park let them know. On the other hand, if you did want to meet people, in the words of Bobby Thin Lizzie Robinson at the Lazy Days Mobile Home Park in Quartzsite, Arizona, just open the hood of your truck. Plenty of people will come by to help you. Miss Hud and I took our time on the road and went where we pleased when we wanted to, keeping the shiny side high, the rubber side low, and if you ever get in a rush, just leave early. Just like Robbie Cricket McKenzie told us when we were pulling out of a creekside trailer park in Gadsden, Alabama. Note to self, common sense is like money and health. Once you have it, you got to work to keep it. On one film shoot, Miss Hud and I settled into the trailer park on the Squamish Nation Indian Reserve just south of the Second Narrows Bridge in Vancouver, Canada. The chief of the reservation, Mike Hunt,